Florence had been ruled by the Medici family, who, however, had been unseated in 1494 when the city became a republic. In 1512, Pope Julius II financed an army to take Florence by force, overthrow the republic, and restore the Medicis to power. The plan succeeded, and the Medicis took control, well in Julius's debt. A few weeks later, Machiavelli was sent to prison, vaguely implicated in a conspiracy against the Medicis. He was tortured but refused to talk, whether about his own involvement or that of others. Released from prison in March 1513, he retired in disgrace to a small farm owned by his family a few miles outside Florence. Machiavelli had a close friend and a man called Francesco Vettori, who had managed to survive the change in government and to ingratiate himself with the Medicis. In the spring of 1513, Vettori began to receive letters in which Machiavelli described his new life. At night he would shut himself up in his study and converse in his mind with great figures in history, trying to uncover the secrets of their power. He wanted to distill the many things he himself had learned about politics and statecraft. And, he wrote to Vettori, he was writing a little pamphlet called De Principatibus, later titled The Prince, where I dive as deep as I can into ideas about this subject, discussing the nature of princely rule, what forms it takes, how these are acquired, how they are maintained, how they are lost. The knowledge and advice imparted in this pamphlet would be more valuable to a prince than the largest army. Perhaps Vettori could show it to one of the Medicis, to whom Machiavelli would gladly dedicate the work. It could be of great use to this family of new princes. It could also revive Machiavelli's career, for he was despondent at his isolation from politics. Vettori passed the essay along to Lorenzo de' Medici, who accepted it with much less interest than he did two hunting dogs given to him at the same time. Actually, the prince perplexed even Vettori. Its advice was sometimes starkly violent and amoral, yet its language was quite dispassionate and matter-of-fact. A strange and uncommon mix. The author wrote the truth, but a little too boldly. Machiavelli also sent the manuscript to other friends who were equally unsure what to make of it. Perhaps it was intended as satire? Machiavelli's disdain for aristocrats with power but no brains was well known to his circle. Soon, Machiavelli wrote another book, later known as The Discourses, a distillation of his talks with friends since his fall from grace. A series of meditations on politics, the book contained some of the same stark advice as the earlier work, but was more geared toward the constitution of a republic than to the actions of a single prince. Over the next few years, Machiavelli slowly returned to favor and was allowed to participate in Florentine affairs. He wrote a play, Mandragola, which, though scandalous, was admired by the Pope and staged at the Vatican. He was also commissioned to write a history of Florence. The Prince and the Discourses remained unpublished, but they circulated in manuscript among the leaders and politicians of Italy. Their audience was small, and when Machiavelli died in 1527, the former secretary to the Republic seemed destined to return to the obscurity from which he came. After Machiavelli's death, however, those two unpublished works of his began to circulate outside Italy. In 1529, Thomas Cromwell, the crafty minister to Henry VIII of England, somehow got hold of a copy of The Prince, and, unlike the flightier Lorenzo de' Medici, read it closely and carefully. To him, the book's historical anecdotes made for a lively and entertaining read. The plain language was not bizarre, but refreshing. Most important, the amoral advice was in fact indispensable. The writer explained not only what a leader had to do to hold on to power, but how to present his actions to the public. Cromwell could not help but adapt Machiavelli's counsel in his advice to the king. Published in several languages in the decades after Machiavelli's death, The Prince slowly spread far and wide. As the centuries passed, it took on a life of its own. In fact, a double life. Widely condemned as amoral, yet avidly read in private by great political figures down the ages. The French minister Cardinal Richelieu made it a kind of political Bible. Napoleon consulted it often. The American president John Adams kept it by his bedside. With the help of Voltaire, the Prussian king Frederick the Great wrote a tract called The Anti-Machiavel, yet he shamelessly practiced many of Machiavelli's ideas to the letter. As Machiavelli's book reached larger audiences, his influence extended beyond politics. Philosophers from Bacon to Hegel found in his writings confirmation for many of their own theories. Romantic poets, such as Lord Byron, admired the energy of his spirit. In Italy, Ireland, and Russia, young revolutionaries discovered in the discourses an inspiring call to arms and a blueprint for a future society. Over the centuries, millions upon millions of readers have used Machiavelli's books for invaluable advice on power. But could it possibly be the opposite? That it is Machiavelli who has been using his readers? Scattered through his writings and through his letters to his friends, some of them uncovered centuries after his death, are signs that he pondered deeply the strategy of writing itself and the power he could wield after his death by infiltrating his ideas indirectly and deeply into his readers' minds, transforming them into unwitting disciples of his amoral philosophy. Interpretation. Once retired to his farm, Machiavelli had the requisite time and distance to think deeply about those matters that concerned him most. First, he slowly formulated the political philosophy that had long been brewing in his mind. To Machiavelli, the ultimate good was a world of dynamic change in which cities or republics were reordering and revitalizing themselves in perpetual motion. The greatest evil was stagnation and complacency. The agents of healthy change were what he called new princes. Young, ambitious people, part lion, part fox, conscious or unconscious enemies of the established order. Second, Machiavelli analyzed the process by which new princes rose to the heights of power and often fell from it. Certain patterns were clear. The need to manage appearances, to play upon people's belief systems, and sometimes to take decidedly amoral action. Machiavelli craved the power to spread his ideas and advice. Denied this power through politics, he set out to win it through books. He would convert readers to his cause, and they would spread his ideas, witting or unwitting carriers. Machiavelli knew that the powerful are often reluctant to take advice, particularly from someone apparently beneath them. He also knew that many of those not in power might be frightened by the dangerous aspects of his philosophy, that many readers would be attracted and repelled at the same time. The powerless want power but are afraid of what they might have to do to get it. To win over the resistant and ambivalent, Machiavelli's books would have to be strategic, indirect, and crafty. So he devised unconventional rhetorical tactics to penetrate deep behind his readers' defenses. First, he filled his books with indispensable advice, practical ideas on how to get power, stay in power, protect one's power. That draws in readers of all kinds, for all of us think first of our own self-interest. Also, no matter how much a reader resists, he or she realizes that ignoring this book and its ideas might be dangerous. Next, Machiavelli stitched historical anecdotes throughout his writing to illustrate his ideas. People like to be shown ways to fancy themselves modern Caesars or Medicis, and they like to be entertained by a good story. And a mind captivated by a story is relatively undefended and open to suggestion. Readers barely notice that in reading these stories, or rather in reading Machiavelli's cleverly altered versions of them, they are absorbing ideas. Machiavelli also quoted classical writers, adjusting the quotations to suit his purposes. His dangerous counsels and ideas would be easier to accept if they seemed to be emerging from the mouth of a Livy or a Tacitus. Finally, Machiavelli used stark, unadorned language to give his writing movement. Instead of finding their minds slowing and stopping, His readers are infected with the desire to go beyond thought and take action. His advice is often expressed in violent terms, but this works to rouse his readers from their stupor. It also appeals to the young, the most fertile ground from which new princes grow. He left his writing open-ended, never telling people exactly what to do. They must use their own ideas and experiences with power to fill in his writing, becoming complicit partners in the text. Through these various devices, Machiavelli gained power over his readers while disguising the nature of his manipulations. It is hard to resist what you cannot see. Understand. You may have brilliant ideas, the kind that could revolutionize the world, but unless you can express them effectively, they will have no force, no power to enter people's minds in a deep and lasting way. You must focus not on yourself or on the need you feel to express what you have to say, but on your audience, as intently as a general focuses on the enemy he is strategizing to defeat. When dealing with people who are bored and have short attention spans, you must entertain them, sneaking your ideas in through the back door. With leaders, you must be careful and indirect, perhaps using third parties to disguise the source of the ideas you are trying to spread. With the young, your expression must be more violent. In general, your words must have movement, sweeping readers along, never calling attention to their own cleverness. You are not after personal expression, but power and influence. The less people consciously focus on the communicative form you have chosen, the less they realize how far your dangerous ideas are burrowing into their minds. By Niccolò Machiavelli, in a letter to Francesco Guicciardini. For some time I have never said what I believed, and never believed what I said. And if I do sometimes happen to say what I think, I always hide it among so many lies that it is hard to recover it. Keys to Warfare. For centuries, people have searched for the magic formula that would give them power to influence others through words. This search has been mostly elusive. Words have strange, paradoxical qualities. Offer people advice, for instance, no matter how sound, and you imply that you know more than they do. To the extent that this strikes at their insecurities, your wise words may merely have the effect of entrenching them in the very habits you want to change. Once your language has gone out into the world, your audience will do what they want with it, interpreting it according to their own preconceptions. Often, when people appear to listen, nod their heads and seem persuaded, they are actually just trying to be agreeable, or even just to get rid of you. There are simply too many words inundating our lives for talk to have any real, long-lasting effect. This does not mean that the search for power through language is futile, only that it must be much more strategic and based on knowledge of fundamental psychology. What really changes us and our behavior is not the actual words uttered by someone else, but our own experience, something that comes not from without, but from within. An event occurs that shakes us up emotionally, breaks up our usual patterns of looking at the world, and has a lasting impact on us. Something we read or hear from a great teacher makes us question what we know, causes us to meditate on the issue at hand, and in the process, changes how we think. The ideas are internalized and felt as personal experience. Images from a film penetrate our unconscious, communicating in a pre-verbal way, and become part of our dream life. Only what stirs deep within us, taking root in our minds as thought and experience, has the power to change what we do in any lasting way. The historical figure who most deeply pondered the nature of communication was surely Socrates, the great philosopher of classical Athens. Socrates' goal was simple. He wanted to make people realize that their knowledge of the world was superficial, if not downright false. Had he tried to say this conventionally and directly, though, he would only have made his audience more resistant and would have strengthened their intellectual smugness. And so, pondering this phenomenon, and through much trial and error, Socrates came up with a method. First came the setup. He would make a show of his own ignorance, telling his audience of mostly young men that he himself knew little, that any wisdom he was reputed to have was just talk. Meanwhile, he would compliment his listeners, feeding their vanity by praising their ideas in an offhand way. Then, in a series of questions constituting a dialogue with a member of his audience, he would slowly tear apart the very ideas he had just praised. He would never directly say anything negative, but through his questions, he would make the other person see the incompleteness or falsity of his ideas. This was confusing. He had just professed his own ignorance, and he had sincerely praised his interlocutors. Yet he had somehow raised a lot of doubts about what they had claimed to know. The dialogue would lie in the minds of Socrates' targets for several days, leading them to question their ideas about the world on their own. In this frame of mind, they would now be more open to real knowledge, to something new. Socrates broke down people's preconceptions about the world by adopting what he called a midwife role. He did not implant his ideas, he simply helped to deliver the doubts that are latent in everyone. The success of the Socratic method was staggering. A whole generation of young Athenians fell under his spell and were permanently altered by his teachings. The most famous of these was Plato, who spread Socrates' ideas as if they were gospel. And Plato's influence over Western thought is perhaps greater than that of anyone else. Socrates' method was highly strategic. He began by tearing himself down and building others up, a way of diffusing his listeners' natural defensiveness, imperceptibly lowering their walls. Then he would lure them into a labyrinth of discussion from which they could find no exit and in which everything they believed was questioned. According to Alcibiades, one of the young men whom Socrates had bewitched, you never knew what he really believed or what he really meant. Everything he said was a rhetorical stance, was ironic. And since you were unsure what he was doing, what came to the surface in these conversations were your own confusion and doubt. He altered your experience of the world from within. Think of this method as communication in depth. Normal discourse, and even fine writing and art, usually only hits people on the surface. Our attempts to communicate with them become absorbed in all of the noise that fills their ears in daily life. Even if something we say or do somehow touches an emotional chord and creates some kind of connection, it rarely stays in their minds long enough to alter how they think and act. A lot of the time, these surface communications are fine. We cannot go through life straining to reach everyone. That would be too exhausting. But the power to reach people more deeply, to alter their ideas and unpleasant behavior, is sometimes critical. What you need to pay attention to is not simply the content of your communication, but the form, the way you lead people to the conclusions you desire, rather than telling them the message in so many words. If you want people to change a bad habit, for example, much more effective than simply trying to persuade them to stop is to show them, perhaps by mirroring their bad behavior in some way, how annoying that habit feels to other people. If you want to make people with low self-esteem feel better about themselves, praise has a superficial effect. Instead, you must prod them into accomplishing something tangible, giving them a real experience. That will translate into a much deeper feeling of confidence. If you want to communicate an important idea, you must not preach. Instead, make your readers or listeners connect the dots and come to the conclusion on their own. Make them internalize the thought you are trying to communicate. Make it seem to emerge from their own minds. Such indirect communication has the power to penetrate deep behind people's defenses. In speaking this new language, learn to expand your vocabulary beyond explicit communication. Silence, for instance, can be used to great effect. By keeping quiet, not responding, you say a lot. By not mentioning something that people expect you to talk about, you call attention to this ellipsis. Make it communicate. Similarly, the details, what Machiavelli calls le cose piccole, the little things, in a text, speech, or work of art, have great expressive power. When the famous Roman lawyer and orator Cicero wanted to defame the character of someone he was prosecuting, he would not accuse or rant. Instead, he would mention details from the life of the accused. The incredible luxury of his home. Was it paid for out of illegal means? The lavishness of his parties, the style of his dress, the little signs that he considered himself superior to the average Roman. Cicero would say these things in passing, but the subtext was clear. Without hitting listeners over the head, it directed them to a certain conclusion. In any period, it can be dangerous to express ideas that go against the grain of public opinion or offend notions of correctness. It is best to seem to conform to these norms, then, by parroting the accepted wisdom, including the proper moral ending. But you can use details here and there to say something else. If you are writing a novel, for instance, you might put your dangerous opinions in the mouth of the villain, but express them with such energy and color that they become more interesting than the speeches of the hero. Not everyone will understand your innuendos and layers of meaning, but some certainly will, at least those with the proper discernment. And mixed messages will excite your audience. Indirect forms of expression, silence, innuendo, loaded details, deliberate blunders, make people feel as if they were participating, uncovering the meaning on their own. The more that people participate in the communication process, the more deeply they internalize its ideas. In putting this strategy into practice, avoid the common mistake of straining to get people's attention by using a form that is shocking or strange. The attention you get this way will be superficial and short-lived. By using a form that alienates a wide public, you narrow your audience. You will end up preaching to the converted. As the case of Machiavelli demonstrates, using a conventional form is more effective in the long run because it attracts a larger audience. Once you have that audience, you can insinuate your real, and even shocking, content through details and subtext. In war, almost everything is judged by its result. If a general leads his army to defeat, his noble intentions do not matter. Nor does the fact that unforeseen factors may have thrown him off course. He lost. No excuse will do. One of Machiavelli's most revolutionary ideas was to apply this standard to politics. What matters is not what people say or intend, but the results of their actions, whether power is increased or decreased. This is what Machiavelli called the effective truth. The real truth, in other words, what happens in fact, not in words or theories. In examining the career of a pope, for instance, Machiavelli would look at the alliances he had built and the wealth and territory he had acquired, not at his character or religious proclamations. Deeds and results do not lie. You must learn to apply the same barometer to your attempts at communication and to those of other people. If a man says or writes something that he considers revolutionary and that he hopes will change the world and improve mankind, but in the end hardly anyone is affected in any real way, then it is not revolutionary or progressive at all. Communication that does not advance its cause or produce a desired result is just self-indulgent talk, reflecting no more than people's love of their own voice and of playing the role of the moral crusader. The effective truth of what they have written or said is that nothing has been changed. The ability to reach people and alter their opinions is a serious affair, as serious and strategic as war. You must be harsher on yourself and on others. Failure to communicate is the fault not of the dull-witted audience, but of the unstrategic communicator. Reversal. Even as you plan your communications to make them more consciously strategic, you must develop the reverse ability to decode the subtexts, hidden messages, and unconscious signals in what other people say. When people speak in vague generalities, for example, and use a lot of abstract terms like justice, morality, liberty, and so on, without really ever explaining the specifics of what they are talking about, they are almost always hiding something. This is often their own nasty but necessary actions, which they prefer to cover up under a screen of righteous verbiage. When you hear such talk, be suspicious. Meanwhile, people who use cutesy colloquial language, brimming with clichés and slang, may be trying to distract you from the thinness of their ideas, trying to win you over not by the soundness of their arguments, but by making you feel chummy and warm toward them. And people who use pretentious, flowery language, crammed with clever metaphors, are often more interested in the sound of their own voices than in reaching the audience with a genuine thought. In general, you must pay attention to the forms in which people express themselves. Never take their content at face value. Here are further reflections on communication strategies. From the I Ching. The most superficial way of trying to influence others is through talk that has nothing real behind it. The influence produced by such mere tongue wagging must necessarily remain insignificant. From Rules for Radicals by Saul D. Alinsky. When you are trying to communicate and can't find the point in the experience of the other party at which he can receive and understand, then you must create the experience for him. I was trying to explain to two staff organizers in training how their problems in their community arose because they had gone outside the experience of their people. That when you go outside anyone's experience, not only do you not communicate, you cause confusion. They had earnest, intelligent expressions on their faces and were verbally and visually agreeing and understanding. But I knew they really didn't understand and that I was not communicating. I had not got into their experience. So I had to give them an experience. From The Histories by Herodotus. The letter set Cyrus thinking of the means by which he could most effectively persuade the Persians to revolt, and his deliberations led him to adopt the following plan, which he found best suited to his purpose. He wrote on a roll of parchment that Astyages had appointed him to command the Persian army. Then he summoned an assembly of the Persians, opened the roll in their presence, and read out what he had written. "And now," he added, "I have an order for you. Every man is to appear on parade with a billhook." The order was obeyed. All the men assembled with their billhooks, and Cyrus's next command was that before the day was out, they should clear a certain piece of rough land full of thorn bushes, about 18 or 20 furlongs square. This too was done, whereupon Cyrus issued the further order that they should present themselves again on the following day after having taken a bath. Meanwhile, Cyrus collected and slaughtered all of his father's goats, sheep, and oxen in preparation for entertaining the whole Persian army at a banquet, together with the best wine and bread he could procure. The next day the guests assembled and were told to sit down on the grass and enjoy themselves. After the meal, Cyrus asked them which they preferred, yesterday's work or today's amusement. And they replied that it was indeed a far cry from the previous day's misery to their present pleasures. This was the answer which Cyrus wanted. He seized upon it at once and proceeded to lay bare what he had in mind. "Men of Persia," he said, "listen to me. Obey my orders, and you will be able to enjoy 1,000 pleasures as good as this without ever turning your hands to menial labor. But if you disobey, yesterday's task will be the pattern of innumerable others you will be forced to perform. Take my advice and win your freedom. I am the man destined to undertake your liberation, and it is my belief that you are a match for the Medes in war as in everything else. It is the truth I tell you. Do not delay, but fling off the yoke of Astyages at once." The Persians had long resented their subjection to the Medes. At last they had found a leader, and welcomed with enthusiasm the prospect of liberty. By Zen Master Mumon. Even more foolish is one who clings to words and phrases and thus tries to achieve understanding. It is like trying to strike the moon with a stick, or scratching a shoe because there is an itchy spot on the foot. It has nothing to do with the truth. From Samurai Zen, The Warrior Koans, by Trevor Leggett. Yoriyasu was a swaggering and aggressive samurai. In the spring of 1341, he was transferred from Kofu to Kamakura, where he visited Master Toden, the 45th teacher at Kenchoji, to ask about Zen. The teacher said, "It is to manifest directly the great action in the hundred concerns of life. When it is loyalty as a samurai, it is the loyalty of Zen. Loyalty is written with the Chinese character made up of center and heart, so it means the Lord in the center of the man. There must be no wrong passions. But when this old priest looks at the samurai today, there are some whose heart center leans toward name and money, and others where it is towards wine and lust, and with others it is inclined towards power and bravado. They are all on those slopes and cannot have a centered heart. How could they have loyalty to the state? If you, sir, wish to practice Zen, first of all practice loyalty, and do not slip into wrong desires." The warrior said, "Our loyalty is direct great action on the battlefield. What need have we for sermons from a priest?" The teacher replied, "You, sir, are a hero in strife. I am a gentleman of peace. We can have nothing to say to each other." The warrior then drew his sword and said, "Loyalty is in the hero's sword, and if you do not know this, you should not talk of loyalty." The teacher replied, "This old priest has the treasure sword of the Diamond King, and if you do not know it, you should not talk of the source of loyalty." The samurai said, "Loyalty of your diamond sword, what is the use of that sort of thing in actual fighting?" The teacher jumped forward and gave one katsu shout, giving the samurai such a shock that he lost consciousness. After some time, the teacher shouted again, and the samurai at once recovered. The teacher said, "The loyalty in the hero's sword, where is it? Speak." The samurai was overawed. He apologized and took his departure. From The Histories, by Herodotus. The Lydian king Croesus had had Miltiades much in his thoughts, so when he learned of his capture, he sent a command to the people of Lampsacus to set him at liberty. If they refused, he was determined, he added, to cut them down like a pine tree. The people of the town were baffled by Croesus's threat, and at a loss to understand what being cut down like a pine tree might mean, until at last the true significance of the phrase dawned upon a certain elderly man. The pine, he explained, was the only kind of tree which sent up no new shoots after being felled. Cut down a pine and it will die off completely. The explanation made the Lampsacenes so frightened of Croesus that they let Miltiades go. From the Book of Matthew. That same day Jesus went out of the house and sat beside the sea, and great crowds gathered about him, so that he got into a boat and sat there, and the whole crowd stood on the beach. And he told them many things in parables, saying, "A sower went out to sow, and as he sowed, some seeds fell along the path, and the birds came and devoured them. Other seeds fell on rocky ground, where they had not much soil, and immediately they sprang up, since they had no depth of soil, but when the sun rose they were scorched. And since they had no root, they withered away. Other seeds fell upon thorns, and the thorns grew up and choked them. Other seeds fell on good soil and brought forth grain, some 100-fold, some 60, some 30. He who has ears, let him hear." Then the disciples came and said to him, "Why do you speak to them in parables?" And he answered them, "To you it has been given to know the secrets of the kingdom of heaven, but to them it has not been given. For to him who has will more be given, and he will have abundance. But from him who has not, even what he has will be taken away. This is why I speak to them in parables, because seeing they do not see, and hearing they do not hear, nor do they understand. With them indeed is fulfilled the prophecy of Isaiah, which says, You shall indeed hear, but never understand, and you shall indeed see, but never perceive. And lastly, from Human, All Too Human, by Friedrich Nietzsche. Irony. Irony is in place only as a pedagogic tool, employed by a teacher in dealing with any kind of pupil. Its objective is humiliation, making ashamed, but of that salutary sort which awakens good resolutions and inspires respect and gratitude towards him who treats us thus, of the kind we feel for a physician. The ironist poses as unknowing and does so well that the pupils in discussion with him are deceived, grow bold in their belief they know better, and expose themselves in every way. They abandon circumspection and reveal themselves as they are, up to the moment when the lamp they have been holding up to the face of the teacher sends its beams very humiliatingly back onto themselves. Where such a relationship as that between teacher and pupil does not obtain, irony is ill-breeding, a vulgar affectation. All ironical writers depend on the foolish species of men who, together with the author, would like to feel themselves superior to all others, and who regard the author as the mouthpiece of their presumption. Habituation to irony, moreover, like habituation to sarcasm, spoils the character, to which it gradually lends the quality of a malicious and jeering superiority. In the end, one comes to resemble a snapping dog, which has learned how to laugh, but forgotten how to bite. Chapter 31. Destroy from Within. The Inner Front Strategy. A war can only really be fought against an enemy who shows himself, by infiltrating your opponent's ranks, working from within to bring them down. You give them nothing to see or react against, the ultimate advantage. From within, you also learn their weaknesses and open up possibilities of sowing internal dissension. So hide your hostile intentions. To take something you want, do not fight those who have it, but rather join them. Then either slowly make it your own, or wait for the moment to stage a coup d'etat. No structure can stand for long when it rots from within. The Invisible Enemy. Late in 1933, Adolf Hitler appointed the 46-year-old Rear Admiral Wilhelm Canaris chief of the Abwehr, the secret intelligence and counter-espionage service of the German General Staff. Hitler had recently won dictatorial powers as the ruler of Germany, and with an eye on future conquests in Europe, he wanted Canaris to make the Abwehr an agency as efficient as the British Secret Service. Canaris was a slightly odd choice for the position. He came from the aristocracy, was not a member of the Nazi Party, and had not had a particularly outstanding military career. But Hitler saw traits in Canaris that would make him a superior spymaster. Cunning in the extreme, a man made for intrigue and deception, he knew how to get results. He would also owe his promotion exclusively to Hitler. In the years to come, Hitler would have reason to feel proud of his choice. Canaris rigorously reorganized the Abwehr and extended its spy networks throughout Europe. Then, in May 1940, he provided exceptional intelligence for the Blitzkrieg invasion of France and the Low Countries early in World War II. And so in the summer of that same year, Hitler gave Canaris his most important task to date, providing intelligence for Operation Sea Lion, a plan to conquer England. After the Blitzkrieg and the evacuation of the Allied army at Dunkirk, the British seemed deeply vulnerable, and knocking them out of the war at this point would ensure Hitler's conquest of Europe. A few weeks into the job, however, Canaris reported that the Germans had underestimated the size of the English army and air force. Sea Lion would require resources much larger than the Führer had anticipated. Unless Hitler was willing to commit many more troops, it could turn into a mess. This was highly disappointing news for Hitler, who had wanted to knock out England in one quick blow. With his eye on an imminent invasion of Russia, he was unwilling to commit large numbers to Sea Lion or to spend years subduing the British. Having come to trust Canaris, he abandoned the planned invasion. That same summer, General Alfred Jodl came up with a brilliant plan to damage England in another way. Using Spain as a base of operations, he would invade the British-owned island of Gibraltar, cutting off England's sea routes through the Mediterranean and the Suez Canal to its empire in India and points east. A disastrous blow. But the Germans would have to act fast, before the English caught on to the threat. Excited by the prospect of ruining England in this indirect way, Hitler once again asked Canaris to assess the plan. The Abwehr chief went to Spain, studied the situation, and reported back. The moment a German army moved into Spain, he said, the English would see the plan, and Gibraltar had elaborate defenses. The Germans would also need the cooperation of Francisco Franco, dictator of Spain, who Canaris believed would not be sufficiently helpful. In short, Gibraltar was not worth the effort. There were many around Hitler who believed that taking Gibraltar was eminently realizable and could mean overall victory in the war against Britain. Shocked at Canaris's report, they vocally expressed their doubts about the intelligence he had been providing all along. His enigmatic nature, he spoke little and was impossible to read, only fueled their suspicions that he was not to be trusted. Hitler heard his staff out, but a meeting with Generalissimo Franco to discuss the Gibraltar plan indirectly corroborated everything Canaris had said. Franco was difficult and made all kinds of silly demands. The Spanish would be impossible to deal with. The logistics were too complicated. Hitler quickly lost interest in Jodl's plan. In the years that followed, German officials in increasing numbers would come to suspect Canaris of disloyalty to the Third Reich, but no one could pin anything concrete on him. And Hitler himself had great faith in the Abwehr chief and sent him on critical top-secret missions. One such assignment occurred in the summer of 1943 when Marshal Pietro Badoglio, the former chief of the Italian General Staff, who arrested Benito Mussolini, dictator of Italy and Hitler's staunchest ally. The Germans feared that Badoglio might secretly open talks with General Dwight D. Eisenhower for Italy's surrender, a devastating blow to the Axis that Hitler could forestall, if necessary, by sending an army to Rome, arresting Badoglio, and occupying the capital. But was it necessary? Hitler's armies were needed elsewhere, so Canaris was dispatched to assess the likelihood of Italy's surrender. He met with his counterpart in the Italian government, General Cesare Amei, then arranged for a meeting between high-ranking members of both countries' intelligence services. At the meeting, Amei emphatically denied that Badoglio had any intention of betraying Germany. In fact, the marshal was fiercely loyal to the cause, and Amei was very convincing. Hitler accordingly left Italy alone. A few weeks later, however, Badoglio indeed surrendered to Eisenhower, and the valuable Italian fleet moved into Allied hands. Canaris had been fooled. Or was it Canaris who had done the fooling? General Walter Schellenberg, chief of the Foreign Intelligence Branch of the SS, began to investigate the Badoglio fiasco and found two men in Amei's service who had listened in on one of Canaris's talks with their boss. Canaris, they reported, had known of Badoglio's intentions to surrender all along, and had collaborated with Amei to deceive Hitler. Surely this time the Abwehr chief had been caught in the act and would pay with his life. Schellenberg accumulated a thick dossier of other actions that cast more doubts on Canaris. He presented it to Heinrich Himmler, head of the SS, who, however, told his subordinate to keep quiet. He would present the dossier to Hitler when the time was right. Yet to Schellenberg's dismay, months went by, and Himmler did nothing, except eventually to retire Canaris with honors from the service. Shortly after Canaris's retirement, his diaries fell into the hands of the SS. They revealed that he had conspired against Hitler from the beginning of his service as Abwehrchef, even plotting to assassinate the Führer in schemes that had only barely misfired. Canaris was sent to a concentration camp, where, in April 1945, he was tortured and killed. Interpretation. Wilhelm Canaris was a devoutly patriotic and conservative man. In the earliest days of the Nazi Party's rise to power, he had come to believe that Hitler would lead his beloved Germany to destruction. But what could he do? He was just one man, and to raise his voice against Hitler would get him no more than a little publicity and an early death. Canaris cared only about results, so he kept quiet, and when offered the job of Abwehrchef, he seized his opportunity. At first, he bided his time, gaining credibility by his work in the Abwehr and getting to understand the inner workings of the Nazi government. Meanwhile, he secretly organized a group of like-minded conspirators, the Schwarze Kapelle, Black Orchestra, who would hatch several plots to kill Hitler. From his position in the Abwehr, Canaris was to some extent able to protect the Schwarze Kapelle from investigation. He also quietly gathered intelligence on the dirtiest secrets of high-ranking Nazis like Himmler, and let them know that any move against him would result in revelations that would ruin them. Assigned to prepare for Operation Sea Lion, Canaris doctored the intelligence to make England look much more formidable than it was. Assigned to investigate an invasion of Gibraltar, he secretly told the Spanish that to let Germany use their country would spell disaster. Germany would never leave. Hence Franco's alienating treatment of Hitler. In both these cases, Canaris exploited Hitler's impatience for quick and easy victories to discourage him from ventures that could have easily and irrevocably turned the war in his favor. Finally, in the case of Badoglio, Canaris understood Hitler's weak spot, a paranoid concern with the loyalty of others, and coached Amé on how to appeal to this weakness and make a show of Italy's devotion to the Axis cause. The results of Canaris's work from the inside are astounding. One man played a major role in saving England, Spain, and Italy from disaster, arguably turning the tide of the war. The resources of the German war machine were essentially at his disposal, to disrupt and derail its efforts. As the story of Canaris demonstrates, if there is something you want to fight or destroy, it is often best to repress your desire to act out your hostility, revealing your position and letting the other side know your intentions. What you gain in publicity, and perhaps in feeling good about expressing yourself openly, you lose in a curtailment of your power to cause real damage, particularly if the enemy is strong. Instead, the ultimate strategy is to seem to stay on the enemy's side, burrowing deep into its heart. From there, you can gather valuable information, weaknesses to attack, incriminating evidence to publicize. Here, subtle maneuvers, like passing along false information or steering your opponent into a self-destructive policy, can have large effects, much larger than anything you could do from the outside. The enemy's powers become weapons you can use against it, a kind of turncoat armory at your disposal. It is hard for most people to imagine that someone who outwardly plays the part of a loyal supporter or friend can secretly be a foe. This makes your hostile intentions and maneuvers relatively easy to cloak. When you are invisible to the enemy, there is no limit to the destructive powers at your command. From Six Secret Teachings by Tai Kung. Speak deferentially, listen respectfully, follow his command, and accord with him in everything. He will never imagine you might be in conflict with him. Our treacherous measures will then be settled. The Friendly Takeover. In the summer of 1929, André Breton, the 33-year-old leader of Paris's avant-garde surrealist movement, saw a private screening of a film called Un Chien Andalou. It was directed by a Spanish member of the group, Luis Buñuel, and its first image showed a man slicing open a woman's eye with a knife. This, Breton exclaimed, was the first surrealist film. Un Chien Andalou generated excitement in part because of the contribution to it of a new artist on the scene, Salvador Dali, a friend and collaborator of Buñuel's. The director spoke highly to Breton of his fellow Spaniard, whose paintings, he said, could certainly be considered surrealist, and whose personality was supremely peculiar. Soon, others, too, were talking about Dali, discussing what he called his paranoid critical method of painting. He delved deep into his dreams and unconscious, and interpreted the images he found there, no matter what their content, in delirious detail. Dali still lived in Spain, but Breton was suddenly seeing his name everywhere he went. Then, in November 1929, the 25-year-old Dali had his first major show in a Paris gallery, and Breton was transfixed by the images. He wrote of the exhibition, "For the first time, the windows of the mind had opened wide." The late 1920s were a difficult period for Breton. The movement he had founded some 5 years earlier was stagnating, its members constantly bickering over ideological points that bored Breton to tears. In truth, surrealism was on the verge of becoming passé. Perhaps Dali could offer the fresh blood it needed. His art, his ideas, and his provocative character might make surrealism something people talked about again. With all this in mind, Breton invited Dali into the movement, and the Spaniard happily accepted. Dali moved to Paris and established himself there. For the next few years, Breton's strategy seemed to be working. Dali's scandalous paintings were the talk of Paris. His exhibitions caused riots. Suddenly, everyone was interested in surrealism again. Even younger artists. But by 1933, Breton was beginning to rue his inclusion of Dali. He had begun to get letters from the Spaniard expressing great interest in Hitler as a source of paranoiac inspiration. Only the surrealists, Dali felt, were capable of saying pretty things on the subject of Hitler. He even wrote of sexually charged dreams about Hitler. As news of Dali's infatuation with the Führer spread within the movement, it provoked a great deal of argument. Many surrealists had communist sympathies and were disgusted by the Spanish artist's musings. To make matters worse, he included in one enormous painting an image of Lenin in a grotesque pose, exposing oversized buttocks, 9 feet long, propped on a crutch. Many in the surrealist group admired Lenin. Was Dali being deliberately provocative? After Breton told Dali he disliked this rendition of the human buttocks and anus, a delirious profusion of anus images suddenly began to populate the artist's paintings. By early 1934, Breton could stand no more, and he issued a statement, co-signed by several members, proposing Dali's expulsion from the surrealist group. The movement was split down the middle. Dali had both supporters and enemies. Finally, a meeting was called to debate the issue. Dali had a fever and a sore throat. He came to the meeting wearing half a dozen layers of clothing and with a thermometer in his mouth. As Breton paced the room, listing the reasons for his banishment, Dali began to take off and put on his overcoat, jacket, and sweaters, trying to regulate his temperature. It was hard for anyone to pay attention to Breton. Finally, Dali was asked to respond. "I had painted both Lenin and Hitler on the basis of dreams," he said, the thermometer in his mouth making him spit many of his words. "Lenin's anamorphic buttock was not insulting, but the very proof of my fidelity to surrealism." He continued to put on and take off clothing. "All taboos are forbidden, or else a list has to be made of those to be observed. And let Breton formally state that the kingdom of surrealist poetry is nothing but a little domain used for the house arrest of those convicted felons placed under surveillance by the vice squad or the Communist Party." The members of the circle were perplexed, to say the least. Dolly had turned their meeting into a kind of surrealist performance, both making fun of the creative freedom they advocated and claiming it for himself. He had also made them laugh. A vote to exclude him would only confirm the accusations he had leveled at them. For the time being, they decided to leave him alone, but in the meeting's aftermath, it was clear that the surrealist movement was now more divided than ever. At the end of that year, Dali disappeared to New York. Word came back to Paris that he had completely conquered the art world in America, making surrealism the hottest movement around. In the years to come, he would actually emigrate to the United States, and his face would grace the cover of Time magazine. From New York, his fame spread far, wide, and around the world. Meanwhile, the surrealists themselves faded quietly from public view, marginalized by other art movements. In 1939, Breton, disgusted by his lack of control over Dali, finally expelled the Spanish artist from the group, but by then it hardly mattered. Dali himself had become synonymous with surrealism, and it would stay that way long after the surrealist movement had died. Interpretation. Salvador Dali was an extremely ambitious man. Although he appeared eccentric, to say the least, his diaries show the extent to which he applied strategy to get what he wanted. Languishing in Spain early on in his career, he saw the importance of capturing the Paris art world, the center of the modern art movement, if he were to rise to the heights of fame. And if he were to make it in Paris, his name would have to be attached to some kind of movement. That would demonstrate his avant-garde status and give him free publicity. Considering the nature of his work and paranoia critical method, surrealism was the only logical choice. Of course, it helped that Dali's good friend, Buñuel, was already a member of the group, and that his lover, Gala, was also the wife of Paul Éluard, one of surrealism's principal authors and thinkers. Through Buñuel, Gala, and a few others, people Dali called messengers and porters, he spread his name strategically throughout Paris and aimed himself directly at Breton. In truth, Dali despised any kind of organized group and actively disliked Breton, but both could be useful to him. By insinuating his presence through others and suggesting that he was a surrealist avant la lettre, he cleverly managed to get Breton to invite him into the group. Now, as a true surrealist and official insider, Dali could continue to wage his insidious war. At first, he made a show of being a loyal member of the group, the platform from which he spent several years winning over Paris with his striking paintings. The surrealists were grateful for the new life he had given them, but in reality, he was using their name and presence to propel his career. Then, once his fame was secure, he proceeded to dynamite the group from the inside. The weaker the surrealists were internally, the more he could dominate them publicly. Dali deliberately chose Hitler and Lenin as images he knew would disgust many in the group. That would both bring out Breton's totalitarian side and cause a major split among the members. Dali's performance at the meeting to expel him was a surrealist masterpiece in itself, and a strategic blow to any vestiges of group unity. Finally, when the movement was riven with division, he scampered off to New York to complete his campaign. Appropriating the seductive name of surrealism for himself, he would go down in history as its most famous member, far more famous than Breton. It is hard to make your way in the world alone. Alliances can help, but if you are starting out, it is hard to get the right people interested in an alliance with you. There is nothing in it for them. The wisest strategy is often to join the group that can best serve your long-term interests or the one with which you have the most affinity. Instead of trying to conquer this group from the outside, you burrow your way into it. As an insider, you can gather valuable information about how it functions and particularly about its members' hypocrisies and weaknesses, knowledge you can use to wage insidious intra-organizational warfare. From the inside, you can divide and conquer. Remember, your advantage here is that unlike the other members, you have no sentimental attachment to the group. Your only allegiance is to yourself. That gives you the freedom you need to make the manipulative and destructive maneuvers that will propel you to the fore at the other's expense. By Salvador Dali. If you decide to wage a war for the total triumph of your individuality, you must begin by inexorably destroying those who have the greatest affinity with you. Keys to Warfare. The most common form of defense in old-fashioned warfare was the fortress, or walled city, and military leaders strategized for centuries about how to take such structures. The fortress presented a simple problem. It was designed to be impenetrable, to require such an effort to take it that unless doing so was strategically essential, an army would tend to pass it by. The conventional strategy against the fortress was to scale or breach its walls using siege engines and battering rams. Often that meant first besieging it, creating around it circles, known as lines of circumvallation and contravallation, that would prevent supplies and reinforcements from coming in and the defenders from leaving. The city's inhabitants would slowly starve and weaken, making it possible eventually to breach the walls and take the castle. These sieges tended to be quite long and bloody. Over the centuries, however, certain enlightened strategists hit upon a different way to bring down the walls. Their strategy was based on a simple premise. The apparent strength of the fortress is an illusion, for behind its walls are people who are trapped, afraid, even desperate. The city's leaders have essentially run out of options. They can only put their faith in the fortress's architecture. To lay siege to these walls is to mistake the appearance of strength for reality. If in fact the walls are hiding great weaknesses within, then the proper strategy is to bypass them and aim for the interior. This can be done literally by digging tunnels beneath the walls, undermining their strength, a conventional military strategy. A better, more devious route is to infiltrate people inside them or to work with the city's disaffected inhabitants. This is known as opening an inner front, finding a group on the inside who will work on your behalf to spread discontent and will eventually betray the fortress into your hands, sparing you a long siege. In late January 1968, the North Vietnamese launched the famous Tet Offensive against the South Vietnamese and American armies. Among their targets was Hue, the ancient capital of Vietnam, and a city of great religious significance for the Vietnamese people. In the center of Hue is a massive fort called the Citadel, and within the Citadel is the Imperial Palace compound, the heart and soul of Hue. The Citadel has incredibly thick and high walls and is surrounded on all sides by water. In 1968, it was guarded by American soldiers and their allies. Yet the North Vietnamese were somehow able to take the Citadel with remarkable ease. They held it for several weeks, then disappeared from Hue as if by magic after a massive U.S. counterattack. The Citadel was unimportant to them as a physical or strategic possession. What they were after was the symbolism of being able to take it, showing the world that American invincibility was a myth. The capture of the Citadel was a remarkable feat, and this is how it was done. Months before Tet, the North Vietnamese began to infiltrate men into the city and to organize those of their sympathizers who already lived in Hue and worked inside the Citadel. They got hold of detailed plans of the fortress, which allowed them to dig elaborate tunnels under its walls. They were also able to leave stockpiles of weapons at key points. During the Tet holiday, they infiltrated even more of their men into the city dressed as peasants. Confederates inside the fortress helped them to overrun some of the guard posts and open the gates. Melting into the local population, they made it impossible for the Citadel's defenders to distinguish friend from foe. Finally, having reconnoitered the location of the concentrated command structure inside the Citadel, The North Vietnamese were able to take it out right away, leaving the defenders unable to communicate with one another. This created mass confusion, and in the process, the defense of the citadel collapsed. The North Vietnamese called this strategy the Blooming Lotus. It has deep roots in Asian military thinking, and its applications go far beyond war. Instead of focusing on the enemy's formidable front, on capturing key points in the periphery of its defenses and finding a way through them, the traditional Western approach, the Lotus strategy aims first and foremost at the center, the soft and vulnerable parts within. The goal is to funnel soldiers and Confederates into this central area by whatever means possible, and to attack it first in order to spread confusion. Rather than trying to penetrate defenses, it infiltrates them. This includes the minds of the enemy soldiers and officers. Strategize